cloudy day. And when it's cold outside, I've got the month of May.
Wonderful presentation by one of the persons there, part of the program, who recited the Emancipation Proclamation very, very theatrically and strongly, and that was really great. Two, Bill Doggett's fantastic exhibition on the slave trade. And you can see all of that is still up. It'll be up through, I believe, all of February, and there's going to be a reception there. And he's going to talk about that on today's show. We're going to rebroadcast last Friday's show, December 28th. And we're going to also listen to Brother Ayo is going to talk about Zimbabwe and why we need to lift the sanctions. This country has sanctions on Zimbabwe, which are hurting the people, and why we should lift those sanctions. And then we're going to close with a conversation with Vexen Noir, also known as Veronica Combs, who is the she produced this wonderful theatrical program called Liquid Fire, where women are honoring and celebrating their sexuality, and it's really well respected and anticipated citywide production of theater that has now shifted into a more introspective performance that features Veronica singing, and we have one of her debut CD, which is being released this month, and it's called Dangerous, and she is at the end of the show, so we're going to play that as well. So we're going to play maybe another one from Larry Vann's Live at the Bajaba Showcase, and this one's called Sometime in the Big City, which is an original piece.
One, two, three. It's hot, and the girls are oh so pretty. Listen, it's summertime, kids playing in the street, running after the ice cream truck as it slowly rolls down the street. It's summertime, and there's fun everywhere. Maybe at the beach, or kicking it at the fair. Summertime in the big city. The weather's hot and the girls are oh so pretty. Yeah, it's summertime, it's summertime. In the big city.
weather's hot and the girls are oh so pretty. Listen. Bright lights of the city glow like jewels in the night. The smooth breeze of the bay keeps the city cool at night. Night cruise on the bay, dinner by candlelight, with the moon and stars to guide as we cruise through the night. Summertime in the big city. The weather's hot and the girls are oh so pretty.
Interview that we broadcast on Friday the 28th. I want to share a little bit of Wanda's Picks January 2013, and it's it's self-explanatory. I remember when I first met Jane Cortez. I was with Elsie Washington, the late fiction writer who wrote the first black romance novel, which I owned. A subscriber to the Harlequin series, I recall when my then husband surprised me with the book, the first with a black couple on the cover. I was smitten. Little did I know that Elsie would fall in love with Kamau Say too and move to Oakland. A good friend of Kamau, I became a great friend of Elsie's, and she would let me tag along to events where she knew everyone, like our sister Jane Cortez, whose work I knew. I was awestruck, still am. The awe just shifts into other dimensions when the borders open and we disappear from view. I was just thinking about Jimmy McCracklin's passing earlier December, and then I hear on NPR that Cortez made her transition December 28th, 2012. She was born May 10th, 1936. I plan to see Jane Cortez at the Vision Festival my 49th year. San Francisco A were just coming to trial, and my standby passage was not honored. I was to stay, if I had made it to New York, with Billy Bang and his partner. They even bought a sofa for me to sleep on. Miss Cortez was to perform at that festival that year. I had known she was Denardo Coleman's mother, Ornette Coleman's ex-wife. Nor did I know her present partner, Melvin Edwards, did most of the wonderful cover art on her books. I just remember thinking how cool it would be to hear her perform. I know when to be still, and that was such a moment. Just as it was once again when I trailed Elsie, and she introduced me to the editor of the Black Literary Review, and another time to Walter Mosley, my students were so lucky when she substitute taught for me one day at the College of Alameda. Sister Jane Cortez, Arizona native, raised in California, an activist in the civil rights movement and a diaspora citizen. This year, on the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, we all need to heed the words of Sister Cortez and rededicate ourselves to the battle for justice and righteousness because, as she writes, and if we don't fight, if we don't resist, if we don't organize and unify and get the power to control our own lives, then we will wear the exaggerated look of captivity, the stylized look of submission, the bizarre look of suicide, the dehumanized look of fear, and the decomposed look of repression forever and ever and ever. And there it is. Jane Cortez was 76 when she passed. I believe Jimmy McCracklin was 90. Fontella Bass, singer of Rescue Me, she died at 72. As well this past week. My condolences to their families and friends, and we will miss them, but at least we still have their work. At least we have their work. It's wonderful when one leaves a legacy. So we're going to play one more song of Mr. Larry Vann's. It's called Big Chief. It's a shout out to the New Orleans natives, of whom I'm one. And then I think we'll play Vexen Noir's Dangerous, and then we'll shift right into the previously broadcast show, December 28th. I don't know if I'm going to pop back in and say anything, but here's Mr. Vann's Big Chief.
We're going to go down to New Orleans. A lot of fun.
Welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was a little tiny, tiny bit of Tina Kari's, and you can help me pronounce this, Ayotunde.
Yes.
Babakumba. I think that's how you say it. And that was in your honor. We're joined in the studio with a wonderful, illustrious guest, Ayotunde Akindele. I love your name. It's so beautiful. And Habari Ghani, everybody. Ujima.
Habari Ghani Ujima.
Ah, yeah. Collective Work and Responsibility. What a wonderful day to be speaking to you, my dear brother. Why don't we start with talking about your petition, What About Us? And to President Barack Obama and the Congress of the United States to remove the sanctions on Zimbabwe, a place that
is really dear to your heart because you lived there for 25 years, right?
Actually, 26 years, yes. And
26 years, yeah,
and
yeah.
Ujima to you this morning, too, my sister. Yes, 26
so
years.
Yeah, so let's start there, and then I'll intersperse some of your, you know, biographical details.
Okay. Well, to kind of give you some background on it, you want to know my time in Zimbabwe or the reason for the petition? Or?
Let's start with the petition and then we'll go backwards.
Okay.
Because I think that, you know, the petition is we want people to know about it, and because I thought that was like really primary. And
mm-hmm.
then we can come back to that, you know, so maybe do sort of a securitist kind of loop.
Okay. With the petition, the inspiration for the petition came from, one, my 26 years in Zimbabwe, my second home, and giving back to my people there, although it will benefit our people all over the world if we can accomplish this feat. The people there in general, Zimbabweans, are very loving, caring, energetic, hardworking people, and generally we tend to forget in a situation like this where there's sanctions or an attempt for, I won't call it regime, I'll call it governmental change or power change within the country. We generally forget about the ordinary people and focus only on the leadership of the country. It's kind of like when you mention the name of Zimbabwe, you automatically think of Mugabe or Tsvangirai or someone, and you don't consider the ordinary people who, for the most part, are struggling. So I thought, well, and then I had a project because I had been in business there. I have a company still registered there. And I had been seeking finance since I got back here last year for projects there. One main project in particular is the Chapati Great Zimbabwe Leisure Resort. And I would be contacting people from all over the world, banks, institutions of finance, you name it. And I would find people interested in investing in the country, but then they would say no because of the sanctions. We'll wait and see what happens. So that became very frustrating. So on top of everything else that's happening within the country with people, daily lives, you know, water shortages and electrical cuts daily, and I witnessed it myself on a day-to-day basis. You know, I had to deal with that too. So it's not something I'm just talking about. It's something I lived also. Times are hard. And it's, even if you live in the suburbs, you are affected by electrical shortages, or you come home and the electricity is not on and you can't cook, or you have to cook outside with a fire or something. And that's commonplace. So I thought, well, let me start. A petition was the thing that came to mind, and it was encouraged by another email I had gotten from a colleague who was asking for a signature for a petition. So that kind of, for change.org, so that kind of encouraged me to get into the petition itself. And the petition I entitled, What About Us?, is related to what I was just talking about, us being the ordinary Zimbabweans, the masses in the country who are forgotten. So the question, What About Us?, is the title, and then addressed to the President, Barack Obama, and the Congress of the United States, which is where mainly a bill commonly called ZEDERA, which is the Zimbabwe economic, Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act of 2001. And it says a number of different things, but the main purpose of it has been to target the President Mugabe and his leadership of ZANU-PF, and to create a situation where the people become disgruntled because of shortages and all the other things that are related to it, and some of the things I mentioned, and topple the government. That hasn't happened. In the process, the people have been suffering. So I felt, well, let me do this initiative and see what I can do to make my contribution towards improving the lives of our people there.
Is it a similar situation to that relationship the United States has with Cuba and former President Fidel Castro? You know, the mm-hmm. sanctions, the antagonism, yeah. the difficulty in traveling or yeah. sending resources to people, like, for instance, somebody might, Zimbabweans here, have trouble sending resources to their families there. Is it a similar type of sanction and situation?
It's a similar type of situation. It's you know, it's antagonistic, it's depressing, it's suppressing, because you can have, you know, U.S. companies, in particular, and financial institutions are basically restricted, although they can go against the restriction and take the initiative, but who would do that? There are few. Interestingly enough, well, I won't get into mentioning names now as to who's there, but yes, to answer your question, that does happen. It happened in Yugoslavia, and it can take years in some cases, in other cases less than that. It depends on the degree and the severity of the conditions and, you know, the reaction of the people to all that. And fortunately for Zimbabweans, being one educated, as it's mentioned in the that they are probably one of the most educated people on the planet, definitely in Africa. And when you have that level of understanding, and that's something that many people don't talk about when they talk about Zimbabwe, they always talk about the bad stuff, but when we talk about trying to improve the lives of people and upgrade the standard of living in a country, we mention education at the top of the list, but that's generally not mentioned when it's referred when we're discussing Zimbabwe. And that makes a difference when the people are intelligent enough to kind of understand where they are and where they should be going and being able to sort out their own problems. And every country has its own problems of leadership and corruption and economics. So it's a common human problem. And Zimbabwe is no different than any other country in that regard. But they deserve the right to self-determination like any other country to solve their own problems. And,
right.
You know, so that is the case, yes. When you get a shortage of money, and that's a major issue, right now the main currency is the U.S. dollar, and that's an expensive way to operate a country. And that's mainly because production is down, manufacturing is down, and there's not enough commerce to support their own currency right now. So they've had to adopt the U.S. dollar. And that makes it a bit difficult because if you have sanctions, you don't have enough U.S. dollars coming into the country via investment and financial support. So you end up scrambling over the crumbs to try to make your business work, and at the same time government needs to supply electricity and social services to the people and so forth. So, and you have people who will be fighting over the crumbs. That's where the corruption comes in. So, So in time, you know, depending again on the people, they can go over the cliff, so to speak, you know, or they can stand firm and continue to fight. And fortunately, as I said, there are people who are very resilient. But, you know, resiliency can only go but so far. And that's why I'm saying, you know, they can be a perfect example of democracy, progress, an African nation that is doing well in agriculture and in manufacturing and education and socially. But with these sanctions, it's making it difficult for them to maintain and be that example that they've been.
Yeah. Let's shift a little bit. I know people are probably really familiar with some of the artists here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Some of the artists like Thomas Mafuma, who comes through. He's in Pacific Northwest. Oliver Mutukuzi, who comes through a lot. And I've actually had Oliver Mutukuzi on my radio show before. And there have been plays about Zimbabwe, the great Zimbabwe, which used to be Rhodesia, and there was, you know, this, you know, British ruler, Rhodes. what was his first name?
Cecil.
Yeah, that named the country after himself. Cecil Rhodes was like, he is like such a villain. And and when I think about, you know, sort of the great Zimbabwe and the Shona people and the Shona culture, and I'm sort of reminded of what happened with Sekou Toure and Guinea, and how when that country got its independence, they removed or had, you know, asked that all of the foreigners, particularly, you know, the former, what do you call those people?
Colonizers.
Colonizers, like, get the heck out of here. We don't want any of your, we don't want you here anymore. And then what happened was, because they kicked those folks out, they were ostracized, and they couldn't develop their commerce because the former colonizers pressured all of the surrounding countries, to not do business with Guinea and not support this leader's position. I mean, okay, you do business with the former enemy, and I don't, but we can still do business with each other. And so that country is still reeling from that those type of economic sanctions. It sort of reminds you of when, you know, they do the urban renewal in the United States, and they just let our communities just say, first they go in and they take them within the domain, and then they just let the whole community just go into despair and just look like a wasteland. And then they come and, oh, let's renew it. it was thriving before they went in and took it over. So
I think Harlem,
a little bit about the history of this great place and what took you there initially. I know you started lots of businesses and things like that, but, you know, as a Pan-African, what took you to, you know, the great Zimbabwe? What took you to Southern Africa specifically? You were in Nigeria, but then most of your life, you know, that you spent in Africa was in Southern Africa, and you're even, what did you say? You say you have citizenship,
I have permanent residence.
You can go back. You got a home in, on the continent of the motherland. That's hot.
I was reminded of that, in fact, this morning, early this morning on the phone call to Zimbabwe. How can I say? You know, Zimbabwe is a special country. I was considering, I went to Nigeria just to go through that. Can I go through that apart first? I went to Nigeria.
Yeah, definitely.
My African experience. Let me give you a little background. When I left, I was at a somewhat of a reaching a African conscious stage. Meaning my learning, some background on Africa, my African identity, my relationship and connectedness to African people. And I started to look around at other institutions, organizations, to see where I can get information, you know, African people from the continent, African people here, who are African conscious. I wanted to get in touch with to get more knowledge and understanding. And organizations like TransAfrica, you know, I would maybe attend a meeting or two of theirs. There was another brother who was going back and forth who had some projects in Sierra Leone and Liberia. So that got me more interested and encouraged, and I met more Nigerians because there's so many Nigerians around the world, and they'd encouraged me to come to Nigeria. So my consideration at the time was Nigeria, because I had met so many Nigerians, and is a big country, you know, that becomes attractive to you, so you think the opportunities are there. The other option was Zimbabwe because of President Mugabe being a very steadfast, you know, serious leader, and ZANU-PF and the struggle of liberation, the history of struggle and accomplishment of liberation in the country attracted me. Jewish Nyerere in Tanzania was another, and then Lesotho, a little country within South Africa, because I had a contact in Lesotho. So I decided to go to Nigeria, and for a couple of weeks, about 2.5 weeks, and I used to tell people Nigeria was my institute of international education that I went through, because if you can live 2.5 weeks at that stage of my life in Nigeria, you've done something, because you think you're in the fast lane in New York. You go into Lagos, Nigeria, it's another fast lane altogether. But it was an interesting and experience, culturally especially. I learned a lot. And one of the main things at the time, their dollar was worth like, what is it, $2.56. I'll never forget that. It took $2.56 U.S. money to equal 1 naira, and that was in 1981. So I thought when I went to Nigeria, I had megabucks, you know, I could buy up Nigeria. But that reality changed very quickly, you know, living on a day-to-day basis. And I had a brother who was good. He had a business there. I had accommodated him a couple of days in here in California where I was staying when he came to visit. So he reciprocated when I got there. So you ever get to Nigeria. So he took care of me as my host. He happened to be a high court justice also. So the contacts were there. It just didn't work out. I didn't have enough money to do what I wanted to do, which I thought I would be able to do. So eventually we had to come back to the U.S. and regroup. And during that process, I had found Wolsey Community Church. And I'm not a joiner of organizations and things like that. I'm more of a loner. But when I found Wolsey, I said, well, these are people of African consciousness, of like mind, or the mind that I'd like to reach. And there would be brothers and sisters from around the country and the continent, and I like that. So that was in 81 when I came back. I joined there, and I was with them until 83 when I went back out again. And Wolsey was kind of my launching pad back to Africa. So I decided that of Tanzania, Zimbabwe, and Lesotho, I would go to Lesotho first because I had contacts there. And I was invited down to stay. And the gentleman who was our contact was the permanent secretary in industry and commerce. So that gave us a way to get into Lesotho, and we registered our company there, we being myself and my ex-wife. And we had registered company, that's where African Unities had started, and we were making black baby dolls and printing T-shirts, cultural, educational, and conscious T-shirts. And I was doing the printing, and the ladies were making the dolls. And we had 8 ladies working with us at the time making the dolls. And we were doing it out of our house. The problem not staying there, we were there for 8.5 months, but because Lesotho's enclosed within South Africa, they call it the Mountain Kingdom. It's a beautiful little country. It's still the only country in the world that has all its landmass that high, elevated that high, so they call it kingdom in the sky. And you would have to get your supplies and things from South Africa, and this was during apartheid, like 1983, 84. that was against my principles, so I refused to go into South Africa. And it's interesting because people would do this, you know, on a day-to-day basis. You know, it's like you want to go to local shopping malls, do some shopping over the weekend. They will go into South Africa. So I don't know, I can't get my T-shirts and all that stuff from South Africa. So I looked around and ended up getting T-shirts from Zimbabwe into Lesotho in order to conduct our business. So eventually we decided that it wasn't going to work. And in the process, I mean, it was nice in Lesotho, but at the same time it was hectic because being surrounded by South Africa during apartheid, often in the evening you would hear gunshots and, you know, explosion type stuff, and mostly activity around the border, and where we were staying was not far from the border. So that was a bit hectic. So we decided, let's make a move, and we chose Zimbabwe because we had met a couple of brothers in Zimbabwe, in Lesotho, who were from Zimbabwe. They were studying at a Catholic school. So they had given us contacts to get in touch with when we would arrive in Zimbabwe, who would help us. So we decided, okay, put everything. We had a Peugeot 404 station wagon. We put all our stuff in the car that we could take. We left our sewing machines and all that stuff with the ladies and told them they can carry on with the business on their own. And we just took what we could, my printer and other stuff, and two dogs, and loaded up in the car, sedated, of course, and drove 14 hours to Zimbabwe. And then they got to the border of Zimbabwe. Well, even before we got there, you know, I have to tell this part. Driving through South Africa is most of the ride. Once you get out of Lesotho, it's not far into South Africa. So you cross the border, you have to drive all through South Africa, then get to Zimbabwe. South Africa is a big country. So along the way, we were stopped. After we had stopped at a gas station, which they call petrol stations, and we wanted to get some gas, go to the toilet. Now, when I got out of the car to go to the toilet, there are signs outside the toilets, blacks only and whites only. Hey, this is 1983, right? And I'm fresh out of America, born and raised in Harlem. You going to tell me I can't go in any toilet I want to as long as it's for men? And reality hit me. I'm going to go in whatever toilet I want. If it says men, I go in men. So I didn't go into the black only. I went into the regular toilet. Came out, and there was interestingly a truck getting petrol, big black pickup truck with the big headlights and the radio antennas and all that, and he was looking at us. So we noticed it. Well, we went ahead, got our gas, got in the car. About 2 miles down the road, we were stopped. Interestingly, by a brother and another white cop, you can call them policemen, but they were on the road. There's another term for them. So they pulled us over. They wanted to know where we were going, where we were coming from, and so forth. And obviously this was from us having done what we had done at the gas station. So, you see, Because remember, we're in South Africa now, and this is during apartheid. And why would you go into a white toilet when you are black? So we immediately connected that because of the questions that they were asking and so forth. So we said, well, listen, you know, we're on our way to Zimbabwe, and we need to get there before the border closes, because at that time the border closed at 8 o'clock. It wasn't 24 hours. We need to get there. So I mean, that's all we wanted to do. So, you know, they had these one-way sunglasses, you know, so you can't see the eyes. It's something out of the movie, cowboy-style hat. So they eventually said, okay, you can go. And that was the last event we had of that nature until we got to the border. Then we got to the border in Zimbabwe and drove in. It was just around 8 o'clock. We had just, you know, like screeching in. And it was hot. It felt so good at night. And we drove in, we got in, got out, ran inside, and got to the counter. And, you know, one of the impacting things on you immediately would be you are in a black country. Even though, you know, we're only a few years out of colonization, but at this stage, the majority of the people at the desk, immigration, and so forth, were black. And that's the media thing that impacts on you. So, yeah, this is Zimbabwe. But now they told us, hey, you can't just drive into people's country like this. So we were like, uh-oh, they're going to send us back. So we got through that. When that went on, the discussion of where you're coming from, where you're going, why you can't just drive into people's country, do you have a visa and this, oh, okay, you got a U.S. passport, you don't need a visa, but you still, you can't just drive in. So we went around on that, and one or two other guys would come and ask questions. You know, everybody would be interested, one, because you're African-American. So one of them eventually asked the question, well, who do you know in Zimbabwe? Do you know anybody? And fortunately, the brothers who had suggested we come to Zimbabwe had also given us a name of a brother to contact. So we said, yeah, we know this brother named Chico, and his people own this particular business in town in Harare and so forth. So they were like, oh, you know Chico? So we said, yeah, that's who we are supposed to host and take care of us when we get there. So they all knew Chico. It happens, this young brother. He wasn't a rock star, but he was a dread Rasta. Not really Rasta, but he was dread. And everybody knew about him, and so he was popular. So that's what got us over. So they said, okay, well, put your stuff in the compound. You can sleep in the hotel wherever overnight, and in the morning we'll process you because we're closing now. So I always give thanks. So we were able to leave our things in the compound, and we went in the hotel. And after we booked and everything, we came out in the nice warm air of the night and got on our knees and kissed the ground and gave thanks. We made it. So then the next morning we processed. They processed us through, and we started to drive into Harare. And, you know, Harare's, the infrastructure is all there. It's a very developed country. And the place was busy because when we got in, it was still like mid-morning. So that was our entry, the reason for picking Zimbabwe and the process of getting there. And then after that, it's been like one experience after another. We did find Chico, and he did take care of us. It was interesting when we had first hooked up. after we did our salutations and so forth, and he had to get the keys for, because his parents owned a couple of houses aside from their own, and he had to get the keys for the house where we were going to stay for the first couple of days till we found a place our own. So we had to go to one of the places that they owned, which was like a butchery, a butcher shop, and a grocery shop and stuff. And it was out in what's called a growth point, which is like out of town, on you go on dirt road and stuff. And here we are now, at night, in the dark, no street lamps, on this dirt road, going to get these keys. And it's Fla and I, my wife, and Chico and another brother in the front.
Right.
And
we are out of time, so
okay. We're
going to have to continue this story, which is a great place to stop. What happens next? You're a great storyteller.
Time goes by fast.
Yeah. So we'll have to have you on again to continue this story, maybe next week. So that people won't be left hanging too long. So
okay.
We definitely want to make sure that people know about the petition, What About Us, to President Barack Obama and the Congress of the United States to remove the sanctions on Zimbabwe. And
right. Where
can people go to sign the petition?
If they just go to change.org and go to petitions and ask for What About Us, President Barack Obama and the Congress of the United States remove sanctions on Zimbabwe.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah. So
all
this,
right.
And I think if we get enough people to support us, we will win, because they're unjust. And we say they're illegal because they were never sanctioned by the United Nations. They were just done unilaterally. You know, it's like, I'm going to do it whether you like it or not. I don't need your approval. So that's why they're declared illegal. So, thank you so much for the time with you. And it goes so fast when you're having fun, isn't it?
Right, you're coming from
a fellow
DJ.
If I could just squeeze this in, another benefit to us as a people.
Our other guest is in the studio, so you mean we're already over. So,
All right.
Is it happening this weekend?
No, I was just going to say that Zimbabwe are immense, and I'm encouraging our people, in particular African American people, to invest. Anybody, doesn't matter your race, but our people in particular need to look at investing in Zimbabwe, and we can help assist with that. Okay.
All right, we'll talk about that next time.
All right. Thank you,
Michael. All right, you take
care. Thank you, audience. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. So you've got another fabulous installation set up for us. I mean, you just keep on churning out one after another. And this one here honors the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and it's up. Is it up presently at the the Opera House?
Yes, it's at the Bayview Opera House, and it's quite a showcase. It's visual, beautifully visual, with some very interesting, strong, and probing text. I'm happy to say, in this particular installation, I was able to have more control on what was showcased visually, as well as the nature of the text. So there's a lot of illuminating text with a wide range of rarely talked about statistical data about tribes in Africa that were entrapped in the transatlantic slave trade, which tribes, which people, where their locations. I've also utilized the 1860 census to look at the slavery population by state. So, as well as there are three notable examples of anti-slavery newspapers from my archive that are showcased. One in particular from Christmas Day, 1858. It's actually the New York Weekly Tribune that has an article about the slave trade. basically the slave trade in the United States about 50 years after it was outlawed. And I can actually, perhaps later on in the show, I'll share this quotes from this. It's just amazing what it reveals about how financially remunerative this great Holocaust for Africans was, in fact, for people engaged in it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking as I was just reflecting on just your marvelous work and the range of it. Just since I've met you, I believe that we first started talking, and I came to know you as a archivist and a curator around the Paul Robeson exhibit at the San Francisco Main Library, and then more recently you received, you know, the 2012 Heritage Keepers Award from the Friends of the Negro Spiritual. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you have this wonderful exhibit on Black opera singers, and and then you did a really wonderful piece that was a film and a talk at the African American Museum and Library. You can tell us a little bit about that. And then you inspired one of your colleagues, and you know, based on Alice Walker's book, Why War Is Never a Good Idea, Why Peace Is Always a Good Idea. And that became, that was turned into an opera, which had its debut this February at the Lincoln Center, right?
Actually, you're probably referencing a composer I'm working with, Richard Thompson. In terms of the Lincoln Center Opera, I am not familiar with this one that you're referring, unfortunately.
That was the one. Well, remember you took the picture of Alice Walker at the Afro Solo event.
Yes. That, yes, of course. Yes, that actually was not an opera. It's actually basically a, I want to call it an oratorio, a choral work by Jacqueline Hairston. Jacqueline Hairston and Alice Walker collaborated to create this very special piece for Black History Month last year, or this year, excuse me, 2012.
No, it was this year.
You're right. Yes. But
I
it
know,
wasn't an opera. That's why, that's why I was thrown at that. Wait a minute, opera. No, yes, Jacqueline Hairston is the cousin of the legendary Chester Hairston, who basically would be considered one of the 20th century champions of Negro spiritual, and she was commissioned to basically create a new chorale, and this chorale was based, you know, of course, in the Bay Area, but then she expanded it, and they came, I believe it was on February 19th of this year, to Carnegie Hall, not at Lincoln Center, but actually Carnegie Hall, to present this, basically a world premiere of this specially commissioned work, and I understand it was just awesome. Yes, and so I was supportive of that, but absolutely. But yes, I've had, talking directly to your mention of the journey, my particular journey as a exhibitions curator and archivist, yes, I've been very blessed by my participation here in the Bay Area, since 2009, beginning with the concert singers, San Francisco concert singers, from Slave Songs to the Opera House, from that forward to the exhibition that's at the Bayview Opera House that opens essentially on January 1st. Yes, absolutely. It's been quite a journey, and I'm very honored, and it comes out of a long tradition, out of my family and my ancestors around the whole issue of sharing our deep knowledge as educators. My late mother, Frances Brown Doggett, is actually from a long series of educators who were based in Richmond, Virginia, the Clarks of Richmond, Virginia. So, yeah, so through them, and through me, if you will, to the present.
Right, yeah, and then the work that you did that you ended up making into a film. What was that one called?
That's basically a film. I consider the film currently, it's still a work in progress because I'm going to be doing various different changes. That is also a basically similar to the title that I have on the current exhibition that's at the Bayview Opera House, and that's simply, I call it Emancipation Proclamation, the Journey to Freedom. And what it does, as the exhibition that we're speaking about also does, is look at the journey from freedom, artistic and cultural excellence in Africa, look at that, look at the transition into the transatlantic slave trade, the horrors of the Middle Passage, arrival in the United States and the plantation chapter of the United States, and then focus on the abolition and abolitionist movement, and I call the abolition movement, as well as the Underground Railroad aspect of it, a modern-day Occupy movement. Look at that, and then look at what was involved, the players involved with that, and then move forward into what we are looking at and celebrating basically on January 1st is the 150th anniversary of the issuance by President Abraham Lincoln of the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln issued it initially on September 22nd, 1862, which was commemorated also this year in September, on September 22nd, but it did not go into effect officially until the following year, January 1st, 1863, which is technically commemorated on January 1st of this coming year, 2013, as the 150th anniversary of the event. So both the film and the exhibition are interlinked. My film is really quite interesting, quite visual. I'm very, very grateful for having collaborated and continuing to collaborate with an awesome filmographer in Los Angeles, and Andy Kimmel, and we're tweaking it here and there. We're doing some things, and I will be showing it. You will be seeing it definitely throughout Black History Month, but we're not publishing it formally until a few other things that we're working on are done. But yes, hopefully we can talk again as we look forward towards the 2013 San Francisco Black Film Festival, because I definitely by that time will want to enter it as a independent short. So definitely.
This your exhibit is a part of the San Francisco commemoration of Kwanzaa and January 1st, 2013, the 150th anniversary is going to be really fantastic. I mean, there's going to be so much happening beginning at 2 o'clock across the street from the Bayview Opera House. Awan Ohun Omira is going to be singing in the plaza. And then Dr. Cecile Bibbs is going to be singing spirituals. Gina Frommer, the district vice president of the YMCA, is going to give an address. Members of Infinity Productions are going to read the proclamation and Kwanzaa principles. January 1st is also the principle Imani, or faith. And you have your exhibit. And then Brother Clint and Brother Malik, who were on the show earlier this week, are going to be talking about the Kwanzaa ceremony. And then Adrian Williams, who is the sponsor of the, I think it's the 7th annual, her sponsoring the citywide, San Francisco citywide Kwanzaa commemorations. She and Pierre Harris are going to provide a meal, and this is all free. So I wondered, when African people who were enslaved, learned of the Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862, on January 1st, 1863, a lot of black people held a night vigil. So the December 31st until January 1st was the night vigil. And then on January 1st, that was Emancipation Day, and it was also called the Jubilee. And that is the day that was celebrated as the Day of Freedom. I wanted you to talk historically about Emancipation Day and how, different communities recognize that important legal document.
Well, first off, I'm happy to do that. What I can say first off is that although Lincoln issued the proclamation on the 22nd of September, it was not widely known until much later in the year. And it was done as it's interesting and it's controversial on some level, as Commander-in-Chief in the effort to quell the rebellion by the Confederate States. The Emancipation Proclamation, while it is viewed and is, in fact, what it is, a jubilee, a gift of freedom to enslaved Africans, it also was a military executive order given to the U.S. Army and Navy to basically, as a last, not even a last dish, as a not even beyond an ultimatum, as something that would essentially take the floor, kind of the rug from underneath the Confederate manpower, to threaten and to basically eviscerate their sense of security by taking away the very foundation of their economic and emotional well-being, which was the ownership of Africans, of slaves. So, but of course, going further, as knowledge of the Emancipation Proclamation became clearer to, especially to many slaves in different parts of the Union. And what's interesting on this, and I just have to back up on this, is that the Emancipation Proclamation was focused specifically to free slaves in the 10 Confederate states, in the states of the Confederacy. It did not initially focus freedom for slaves that were in areas that the Union Army, that Grant's Army had already, that is, areas of the South of the Confederacy that had come under Union control. So there was some confusion there, but by the end of 1865, with the 13th Amendment, all African American, or all African slaves, I'm going to call them African slaves because they basically are enslaved Africans, become African American as we know them today. But all enslaved Africans were technically officially freed by the end of 1865 with the 13th Amendment, but the Emancipation Proclamation itself was controversially and politically motivated, even though it is revered in a sense of mythology as the freedom giver. It was that, but there is another side to it, which I do address in the exhibition, but it's a side that some people, as they're beginning to discover, and especially through the, you know, Spielberg's film on Lincoln, that, you know, there was much more to it. You know, it's just, this is so much the case in history. We only have filtered aspects of history. So many, I mean, we can talk, and you have talked with different times, I'm sure, throughout the ages on your show about the contrast of the reality of what it meant for Christopher Columbus and Magellan and Cortez to discover the New World, so to speak, what that meant for them and what that meant for the indigenous populations. It's quite a different thing. You know, when we were growing up in the 60s and in, you know, elementary schools, you know, Columbus Day was revered as a great day of celebration. Obviously, we didn't know the full story about the true history of what that meant for the indigenous populations, as well as what it actually in the long run meant for Africans and Africa in general. Just in the same way, and I'm making the analogy, the connection, linking the dots between that kind of mythology as well as a little bit of the mythology around the Emancipation Proclamation and what it meant, you know, historically, militarily, as well as, I think, culturally. You know, there are differences, but the long of the short, the bigger picture is, of course, that it did, in fact, free the slaves, and it did, in fact, take the rug from underneath the Confederacy enough that, you know, that was the last straw. It's kind of, you know, it's like, you know, it was a device that was interesting on a lot of different levels, and I think it is certainly worth commemorating, and we are greatly, what will I call, we are gratefully embellished in our lives because of it. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. So you mentioned you have in the exhibit black newspapers going back to 1860.
Actually, no. I don't have black newspapers. I have anti-slavery newspapers. These were done by
abolitionist
newspapers.
Right, right.
Yeah. I have the Inquirer from 1846. I have the Inquirer from 1846. I have a Christmas 1858. This one is actually a reporting. It's technically not this one I'm about to talk about is technically not an anti-slavery newspaper, but rather a standard newspaper. But there's a article in it that is just dynamic. And then I do have a third newspaper, which is the final issue of The Liberator, which was the political and newspaper organ of William Lloyd Garrison, who is the quintessential abolitionist founder, if you will. He's one of the main people that when one talks about the abolitionist movement, it is William Lloyd Garrison whose name comes up, along with, of course, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, et cetera. So, yes, I should, and on that note, I should segue to this, since I've been mentioning this quite a bit. So in this article, in this newspaper from December 25th, 1858, there is an article which is showcased in the exhibition called The Slave Trade. I'm going to quickly read from it, quote it exactly. Quote, The Slave Trade. The Washington correspondent of the Boston Advertiser states that a gay and happy festival of the friends of Captain Corey in that city being Boston, celebrated the news of his arrival in the Savannah River of Georgia with his cargo of slaves from Africa, of which an account was given in last week's Tribune. Success to all such enterprises was drunk in flowing bumpers of champagne by the elated company. The New York Herald, yet another newspaper, also states on authority that the cargo of the Wanderer, the ship was called the Wanderer, was much smaller than had been reported. According to this statement, instead of the 300 Negroes, she only brought 80. But these, and this I want to emphasize, these were uncommonly fine specimens, having been selected on the Congo River with special regard to their health, vigor, size, and strength. They were treated with the utmost care on the voyage, and when landed readily brought $700 each. We're talking in December 25th, 1858, $700 each, making $56,000 as the gross proceeds of the cargo, of which at least $40,000 was clear profit, unquote. That really tells it in a way that I think nothing else I've been able to see in the research I've had over the years, just how financially, you know, an economic behemoth this was. I mean, imagine $40,000 clear profit on 80 Negroes stolen from Africa. Isn't that something?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And I presume, go ahead.
No, and in the article goes on to note that there was quite the U.S. authority, the next paragraph that says, meanwhile, the U.S. authorities in Georgia have seized the Wanderer because it was a carrying contract. It's a pirate ship. President Jefferson had outlawed in the acts of the Congressional Acts of 1810 and 1820 the slave trade in the United States. Here we are reporting in Christmas issue of 1858 that this ship, this slave ship, the Wanderer, had managed to get into United States waters and to deliver its cargo. It was supposedly had 300 Negroes. Now, whether the other, 220 were lost in the Middle Passage or were delivered to other locations. It almost sounds like, how would I say, it almost sounds like this contraband deal where someone has, okay, I've got this secret deal with this person in this country, this person that I'm going to deliver 40 to here. You know, I'm going to make this amount of money from this. I'm going to get another 60 here. You know what I'm saying? It's not funny. It's actually tragic to think that this was going on. And there, Jefferson had, there were huge fines that were levied on anyone caught trying to bring Africans into the United States after 1820. And here we are at the end of 1858 with this cargo that shows up in Georgia. Some either series of individuals had, I'm going to use this word, commissioned this captain to go to Africa and capture these people because they needed more people. But look at the money. Look what was involved. Now, if they're, how much they, the tragedy is to even think about the issue of human trafficking. How much did they pay whomever, the go-between, the middleman was in Africa to get these people, to capture them, put them on the ship, and bring them to the. It's this article just brings it really front and center in a very important way. And a series, and much of the exhibition is like this. There are many things that are highlighted, especially as I mentioned earlier, the census of 1860. I can give you in the Confederate States. As well as the, Confederate technically is, 1861, but this is the census of 1860. So in the antebellum South, so where were all the slaves? How many slaves were in each state? Who had the largest, who had the smallest? It's an interesting look at our history in ways that no textbooks have really shown, and I think that's the great value. And in particular, I should say, in connecting all the dots here, is that I'm very honored that Barb Okel, the executive director of the Bayview Opera House, and I had the opportunity to meet, and that she understood the value of the kind of text that I'm writing and the value of just really telling the story in ways that is not just, the pretty textbook versions, but actually gives statistical information. Which tribes, which tribes were taken out of Africa? It's amazing to look at that. You have of all of the, where am I going to say this? Specifically, you look at the fact that certain areas of the west coast of Africa were literally raped, more heavily than others. And if you look at the data, for example, do I have enough time?
Give us the details about specifically where.
Okay,
more than others.
So between 1650 and 1900, you had 10.24 million enslaved Africans arrived in the Americas from the following regions in the following proportions. From Senegal and Gambia, 4.8%. From Upper Guinea, 4.1%. From the Gold Coast, Ghana, and the east of Cote d'Ivoire, 10.4%. From the Bight of Benin, Togo, Benin, and Nigeria, west of Niger, 20.2%. From the Republic of Congo and Angola, this is really interesting statistic, 39.4%. And there were beyond that, and this isn't, and I want to just give a taste of this because the text, and the visual in combination in the exhibition really tell the story much more powerfully. But of the areas that I just mentioned, there were specific ethnic groups that were targeted. And there are 10 in particular that are the most represented and based on slave trade documentation. The Bakongo of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola, the Mande of Upper Guinea, the Gibe speakers of Togo, Ghana, and Benin, the Akan of Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, the Chamba of Cameroon. And so it's just, so all of this kind of information, which I think is very fascinating and very crucial for anyone interested in knowing more depth and detail about our ancestors and which ancestors, you know, were entrapped because these were, many of these ethnic groups were part of larger kingdoms, and the tragedy of some of this is that some of these ethnic groups were ethnic groups that were prisoners of war from intertribal warfare. And so in one of the dark sides that I don't talk about so much in the exhibition but is part of the larger story is that also there were African tribes who had perhaps more power within kingdoms, and there were historic ethnic rivalries. And so in the effort to expand and, you know, all of this, I think this is part of humankind because you hear the stories not just, you know, in Africa, but you see, you know, in Europe and in Asia, that all of these wars for domination created victors and created victims, if you will. So some of the Africans that, and the African ethnic groups that we're talking about were prisoners of war or victims of these tribal wars who were available for basically, you know, to this new energy coming to the coast, the west coast of Africa in 1494 and in the early 1500s. You have Portuguese and Spanish who are, you know, they've got new land. They've got a new world. Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas, you know, and, you know, Europe needs, you know, people to work these lands. You know, voila. We've got all these people, you know, that are prisoners of war, you know, yada, yada. So it's interesting, and that's just part of the story I don't tell, but it's part of the larger story. But the exhibition does tell a story that is much more embracing of the fuller history, and I think that a lot of people will really enjoy it. And I know for in particular, even though there are statistics here, that I've written it in a way that makes it easy to understand by any middle school, high school, or, you know, adult, you know, I call community college, or, you know, adult continuing education. The community, I think, will embrace this exhibition because it's not only visual, but it tells a story in a way that probably very few people have seen it and heard it. So I'm very proud of the opportunity to do that.
Well, I'm sure with the history of your wonderful exhibitions and installations that it's going to be it's of a really high caliber. And I'm speaking to Bill Doggett about the wonderful slavery history exhibition, which is a commemoration of the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And the program is on January 1st, 2013, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Last Day of Kwanzaa, which is Imani, at the Bayview Opera House. It's going to start across the street from the Opera House and then move inside. Would you happen to have the address of the Opera House?
I don't have it right in front of me. I'm embarrassed to say, but it is on.
Oh, that's okay. Bayview.
It's what's the cross street? It's.
Well, I know it's on Third Street.
It's on Third Street, and there's a very large cross street. And I wish I had it in front of me as we speak, but I don't. So I can't tell you.
Okay, well, I will find it and let folks know. But it's a landmark, and you can't miss it. But I'll give you the details a little bit later on in the show. And this is I'm really looking forward to seeing this exhibition. I might not be able to get there before the first. Is it going to be up past the first?
The exhibition will run through the entire month of January and Black History Month. It is anticipated to come down. So this exhibit, and thank you for bringing that up, because there is one other detail that I should share in advance. There will be an artist reception for the exhibition on February 2nd, which is piggybacked with a larger Black History Month event that Dr. Sushil Bibbs is doing. She's doing, I believe, a staged play and reading on Mary Pleasant, as well as the Higher Sisters, two of her specializations, and which of course are very much San Francisco Black History related. So yes, so on February 2nd there will be an artist reception in the evening, and I welcome everyone to come back and enjoy, because at that particular time I will also be doing a demonstration of some of the historical recordings, the earliest recordings of Negro spirituals that are showcased as in there are images of these recordings. Well, I will actually be playing these recordings that are in the exhibition live. These are recordings from 1910 to about 1930 on a vintage gramophone. So it'll be a fun show and tell, especially for people of all ages, and especially for young people. I think that, you know, many people have never seen a 45 RPM, no less a 78 RPM, and certainly have never seen one, you know, an original from, you know, the Fisk Jubilee Singers or Tuskegee or in fact, the very first commercial recording that Marian Anderson made from 1925. I have that as part of my archive, and that is also showcased in the exhibition.
Okay, super. Well, thank you so much. My other guest is hanging out there in the wings, Mr. Larry Vann. We're so happy he's going to be able to join us. So thank you so much, Bill, for joining us once again to talk about your great work. And I'm really looking forward to many visits to the Opera House to see this wonderful exhibition.
Thank you, Wanda. It's been my pleasure to be on, and happy Kwanzaa and Happy New Year.
Happy Kwanzaa and Happy New Year to people left.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Happy birthday, Mr. Vann. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Hello, Wanda. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Congratulations on your new CD. That's so cool. You know, you have a birthday party and you have a new CD, and it's all coming together on the same illustrious day. That's
ain't that cool? God is good.
yeah. Well, hey, you know, you're such a professional, and you've been doing this work for so long. You know, you can make magic happen like that.
Wow. That's a blessing. So, you know, to be still being able to play and just go out there and work it, you know, it's a joy. So to lay the groove down and then get the response from the audience, and it's nice when, you know, we respond back to each other in performance like that. So I love it.
Yeah.
I love the mission I'm on.
Right. You're going to be at the 57th Street Gallery tonight. Is it 8 o'clock or 8:30? 8 o'clock?
It's 8:30.
Okay.
8:30. Show starts at 8:30. Yeah. Yeah, that's and it's 5701 Telegraph Avenue, Oakland. So the 57th Street Gallery, which is a great place. It's really a blessing to have this place in Oakland and have this kind of venue, you know. So it's they always have something really special going on there, so I enjoy playing there. And the art is great there. Have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there. Sure have.
Yeah.
I'm going to be there. Yeah, I've been there before. And, it's, you know, the art changes, but it's always thematically looking at, you know, our creative music.
Yeah. So it's Floyd, Mr. Pelham is the owner, and he really does a great job in his presentation and keeping live music alive, you know, in his establishment. So that's really cool.
So you're 65 today, and you say that you're a groove merchant, always searching for a groove. That's your mission, to find a groove, grabbing it in, locking it in, and you're just a phenomenal drummer. The last time I saw you was at Destiny's birthday party. She was making
that was really cool. That was a great performance, and she's something else. She's too much.
Yeah, but so are you. So who do you have, like, sort of coming in, dropping in to help you celebrate tonight?
Who knows? It's like the who's who. The word has gone out, and I've gotten a lot of response from a lot of people. It's going to be some surprise. It sounds like it may be a surprise guest that I don't want to say nothing about right now. You just have to be there. if he shows up, I'm doing some work with him this weekend, and I can't say his name, but if you show up, you get a chance to see him. But he is truly a world-class legend. I mean, a legend of a legend. So that would be hopefully he's going to be coming down. He's flying in today, so I was told he was going to come drop by. So this particular person.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That's
don't pull my leg. Don't try to fool me into telling you, Wanda, because I can't tell you.
Okay, well, we shall see. So let me read a little bit of your bio. You've made an impressive mark on the Bay Area music scene over the years with your authentic, piercing, all-encompassing musical technique. Authentic root music, the essential substance of your artistic source, is the foundation of your superbly seasoned artist-owned music branding, which fuses the essence of soul, stirring blues, sweet, mellow jazz, and genuine soul, R&B, and funk. In other words, you can play it all. One listens to your compelling, penetrating, and intoxicating grooves clearly demonstrates why you've been in such huge demand for sessions and tours with the likes of Elvin Bishop and Merle Saunders. Your top-notch drumming and percussion has garnered you popular and critical success throughout the United States and Europe, but you've also wowed critics and crowds alike with your sultry singing voice, buoyed by your melodic, inventive songwriting. And you've been a professional performer since 15, and you draw from a deep well of musical influences, including gospel, blues, funk, jazz, and soul. And you've toured and recorded with a medley of celebrated artists, including The Whispers, Martha Reeves, The Marvelettes, Buffy St. Marie, and many others, which you can tell us about. And your career also includes a motion picture role as a nightclub band member in the Academy Award-nominated Take You Sue Got Married. Your honors and awards include the Blues Society West Coast Hall of Fame, Blues Drummer of the Year Award, and the Jazz Institute's Man of the Year Award. You've also been honored to serve as a governor on the governing board of the San Francisco chapter of the Recording Academy. And so tell us about your latest recording, and then maybe we can go back and maybe you can tell us how you got sort of, you know, became this groove master who is so adept in these various genres of the art form. So tell us about your Live as Pajama Showcase, and then we'll sort of go back and you can tell us how you got where you are. I mean, I know we can't do it just really quickly, but maybe we can have you on again some other time to continue the story.
Yeah, well, the live CD, we did a live recording at KPFA on the Bajava Showcase, the Studio Club 94. And it came out so well, we decided to just go on and make a live CD out of what we captured that night in that performance. And it's just a real cool, it's roots, the roots stuff. And I got Mike Warren playing bass and Janice Maxie Reed playing keys. And it just came out great. And Afrikaan Davies, he's the host of that show. So it's really Doug Edwards and his brainchild to have this particular show that comes on every once every month, I think, the first Tuesday of the month. And they focus in on Bay Area talent, you know. And it's just a real cool project. I'm really proud of it and happy that the Lord allowed us to get to this point and release it. So it's really a cool live CD, and I hope everybody picks it up.
Yeah,
you got
it.
So they're starting to play it now.
Yeah, uh-huh. Big Chief, you've got Big Chief on there. She's my old time, used to be, Stand By Me, Smokestack, Lightning, and My Girl.
Yeah.
So are any of these original? Oh, and Summertime in the Big City.
Summertime in the Big City.
There?
Yeah, that's original.
Okay.
Summertime in the Big City is original. But the rest of them are, you know, these are tunes that we've kind of rearranged. Smokestack Lightning is a great tune by one of my idols, Howlin' Wolf, and I just love him and love his work. And Cheese Monkey is a tune that I picked up from T-Bone Walker. I heard him do it, and so I put that into my repertoire. And these are tunes that I've been doing for a good while, and I wanted to just capture them, and I was able to capture them on CD. So, and you know, My Girl, you know that, you know how far that goes back, and people just love that song, and I've always had a good response when we do My Girl and Stand By Me, and you know, I just, these are tunes that I've just been in my catalog for a while, so I have little arrangements of them that we've developed over the years, and just a great, they all have great grooves, and got a little monologue in some of them, you know, so it's they have their own Larry Van kind of groove to it, you know. And Big Chief, I just love, you know, that's from down in New Orleans, you know, and the Indians down there, Mardi Gras, and I just love that, those grooves from that that place in the world. There's nothing like New Orleans. It's like, you know, just an incredible groove down there. It's just like really kind of, I always say it's an untapped resource, and you just, because of who we are and what comes out of that region, is just amazing, you know. And it's a melting pot of a lot of stuff down in New Orleans, and New Orleans is still coming back, so we got to continue to pray for them and always put a little word in about New Orleans, because New Orleans is still trying to come back, you know. So,
yeah, that's so true. That's my hometown. I'm from New Orleans.
Yeah. In what part? New Orleans.
Okay. And stuff. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I grew up in San Francisco, but I was born there. Came here when I was four. On Greyhound.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's something special about down there. I've had the pleasure of playing down there several times, and I played Tipitino's and played Baton Rouge, and it's just amazing to be down there.
Yeah, nice. So are you a native San Franciscan?
Yeah, Bay Area, Oakland.
Oakland, okay.
Oaktown. I'm from Oakland.
Yeah, so you mean like Oakland Public Schools, too?
Yeah, Oakland Public Schools. Really, to be very honest with you, Wanda, that's where I got my my start at. So, I just want to thank the Oakland Public Schools, because that's where I got my feet wet at. You know, I was able to experience performing from the fourth grade on. I played all the way through from the fourth grade to into college, you know. So
nice.
The outlet we had in the public schools at that time was just amazing, because, I mean, we had orchestras, we had concert bands, we had jazz bands and choral groups, big choral groups, small choral groups. I mean, the school district had just gugobs of instruments. So we don't have that now. It's very, very difficult now. But that I thank the Oakland Public Schools, because if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, because I had the wonderful outlet to be able to perform and know what it's like to perform. I used to love doing the concerts at school, you know, the Christmas concerts and all the spring concerts, you know. So it wasn't for Oakland Public Schools, I don't know.
what school?
I went to Lockwood. I went to Brookfield Elementary. James Madison Junior High School in Sobrani Park, Castlemount High School, and you know, Laney College, and then I did went to a 4-year college at Dominican College, a small college in Marin County.
Yeah, and Dominican College. Yeah, nice. And you studied music all the way through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking about Elvin Jones, a wonderful drummer, and how he did, I think he taught some music. His teacher was one of the teachers in the Oakland Unified School District, his teachers, his drum teachers, and I think it was McClymers, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm
okay.
Not sure.
It might have been either Mr. Payson, Joe Payson, which I ended up working with him. He ended up working teaching at James Madison, the junior high school I went to. Well, I went back there when I was in high school to do be a teacher's aide. And I worked in the music department under Mr. Joe Payson. So it might have been Joe Payson. Because I know Andy, he taught John Andy, too.
Okay. Yeah. It probably was him. And he's no longer here, but his wife is. And I think she was at the event.
Oh.
And, Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think they talked about how he would have you all over to their house.
He was so cool by that time. You know, he was an older guy then, but I never went to his house, but I worked with him, and he was a funny guy too. He was really funny. Funny little Italian guy. He was really cool.
Mm-hmm. So what attracted you to the drums, percussion in particular?
You know what? That's a good question. It started in the third grade. Really, I played piano. I was taking piano lessons and stuff, and I got pretty good. Good enough to my teacher, Miss Gussie Johnson, who is also my younger brother's godmother. I got to the point where she was taking me to the Conservatory of Music in San Francisco to be tested, you know. So I'd gotten pretty good. But in the third grade, I remember being out on the playground at Lockwood School, Lockwood Elementary in Oakland. And the school orchestra was having an outdoor concert. It was like a spring concert. And I was out on the playground, and I just happened to look at the drummers, the drum section. And they were, you know, the cats were there, and they had their white shirts on, black ties and slacks, and they were playing. I'm saying, man, that's what I want to do. So when I got in the fourth grade, I asked my mother to sign the form for me to take music. And she asked me what I wanted to do. I said, I wanted to play drums. Mm-hmm. Well, that first year, I didn't do too well. I don't know, the teacher maybe didn't dig me or something. But she kicked me out the class in the fourth grade. But the next year, when it was time to sign up for music again, I brought another form home, and I asked my mother to sign it, and she looked at me. She said, if I sign this, are you going to stick with this? And I looked at her, and I said, yeah. So I kept my word. I haven't stopped yet, thank God. So I went back, and, you know, it was a new teacher, and she was fresh out of college, and she was just really, you know, energetic and had a lot of real cool ideas, and it just worked, you know. And I think I got a blue ribbon for, she did a, she wrote a percussion piece. And in Oakland at that time, they used to have these competitions, and they would come around to schools, and the different groups would play for them, and you could win a a blue ribbon, a red, you know, a yellow ribbon. I think blue was the highest. So the ensemble, the percussion ensemble that I played with, we got a blue ribbon. So, you know, I've just been playing ever since. So.
Wow. Yeah. So you recorded a whole lot, and I was wondering which album is this for you, live at Papa John's?
Say it again.
I said you recorded a whole lot, you know, with a lot of people, and also
yeah.
as a leader. Which album is the Java Showcase? Which one is this for you? Which album?
Oh, you mean number wise?
Yeah, number wise. Or did you stop counting at some point?
Yeah, I kind of stopped counting because I've recorded with so many different people. I've done recording in Europe and with Brian Auger and this Swiss artist named Phil Carmen, who was a big artist over there in Switzerland. I lived over in Switzerland for almost a year working with him and touring. So, that would be a number I'd have to sit down and figure out. But some of the highlights are, you know, like working with Don Cornelius and Dick Griffey, that was really a treat. When I was with the Whispers and working on Soul, I was a staff musician for Soul Train Records. And,
oh, wow. I didn't know Soul Train had records.
Yeah, they had a record label.
Wow.
It was short-lived, and we did the theme song to the show, which was a big treat. And we did it here. We recorded it here in the Bay Area. And a lot of the Bay Area cats are on that record. John Turk is on there. A lot of Bay Area folks. Carl Lockett is playing on it. That was a big treat for me. Playing with Merle Saunders and recording with him over the years. Merle Saunders is my big brother, and I really miss him. Recording with Marvin Holmes. I did my early recording, to go back to, you asked that question, such a great question. The first person to take me in the studio to record was Richard Dimples Fields. Was the first cat to take me in the studio.
Could you tell us who he is? Who is
Richard Dimples Fields is a Bay Area legend. He's passed away now, but I don't know if you remember that song. He had a big hit in like the late 70s, 80s called "If It Ain't One Thing, It's Another." You remember that song? "If It Ain't One Thing, It's Another." And he had Tears Big as Cantaloupes was his big hit way back in the day. But this old school cat and just really one of the, you know, Bay Area legends. But he was the first guy to take me in the studio. And matter of fact, years later, he produced the album, and that particular song was on it. But I can't remember the name of it because I've seen the album, and I wanted to get a copy of that first. The first record I've ever really recorded was on his first album.
Right.
So, but that was the first guy. But, you know, working with Brian Auger, I did a great album in Switzerland with him called Key to the Heart. Like I say, the Soul Train record was really a big one for me, and it really kicks. It's called Soul Train 75. And I wish we had talked about this early, because I could have given you that too. But it's phenomenal. And a lot of legal things were going on. And Soul Train, as I told you earlier, was short-lived. And so it didn't stay on. And what happened is, I don't know what happened with Don and Cornelius and Dick Griffey's relationship as far as the record company was concerned. But right after that, with Soul Train Records, Dick Griffey spun off on his own and created Solar Records. I don't know if you remember Solar. That was, you know, and you know, Ohio Lakeside, all that, you know, Jody Wadley and all that. He spun off and put his own label together, and you know, the rest is history. So.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I remember when Don Cornelius passed, and I remember just sort of reflecting on when I was a kid on Saturday. I remember when Soul Train started because we watched American Bandstand, and it was Soul Train started. It's like, oh my God,
that's
this is so fabulous! And we would watch it. I would watch it, and I practiced the dances. So
but he was a great cat.
Yeah, it was
cat.
So fun. Yeah,
great cat to work with, and just as he was on his TV show, that's how he was in person. He's just really cool. He's a cool guy. And just had a wonderful relationship with him. Him and Dick. Mm-hmm. They were really two cool brothers. And at that time, Dick Griffey was like the top talent agent. He had all the black acts at that time. He was exclusively handling Stevie Wonder at that time. He's doing all his tours and booking. And so you could see the connection from the show, because all those acts that came on Soul Train, Dick Griffey, you know, handled it. He was the talent coordinator, so he was handling all those acts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just really an exciting time, a great time, and to work in, you know, and then, you know, to work in L.A. and be on the scene down there was really cool. So.
Yeah, and did you work with Sweet Jimmy?
Yeah. Sweet Jimmy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm on his first CD that was produced by Marvin Holmes. The first record CD he put out. It was like a compilation, blues compilation, and he included one of my songs off my CD called Look Over Yonder, which is on my first full-length CD, which is the Rhythm and Roots of Larry Vann. So he took one of them. He asked me could he put that on his compilation. I said, yeah, man. So, yeah, I've had the pleasure of working with Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so talk about how you sort of, you know, you're so comfortable in various genres. You know, sometimes people just play one particular kind of music, but I've noticed, you know, with drummers like yourself and like Billy Hart is one that comes to mind when I think about you. You all play all kind of music, and you're just like, you know, fantastic. And then you sing. Could you talk about sort of how, you know, like, did you play? Did you grow up in a church? Did you play there? And I mean, just sort of how you sort of shift and move, and you're so comfortable in all these various kinds of music, and you even write different kinds of styles.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well, it's kind of interesting because, I played in church, and I sang in the chorus and stuff, but really, you know, coming out of the area I came out of, I was really attracted to jazz. Really, really. I mean, I was anything Cal Jada was doing, anything, you know, Miles was doing. I mean, coming up at like 12, 13, I was listening to that stuff, and K-Jazz was like the bomb around here in the Bay Area. That was the jazz station, so it's like, wow, I'd be listening to all that. But I came up, in the community that I came up in, my outlet was really the cats, my partners in the neighborhood, my first band and stuff. We were doing blues. That's how I could get my feet wet, you know, playing blues joints. I was playing in clubs when I was 15. And I think back on it, I said, my parents really trusted me. First gig I had in a blues club was in Richmond, right on Cutting Boulevard, a place called 1212, the 1212 Club. I used to get $12 a night, and I played with this guy called Chico. And Chico would come pick me up, and he had one eye. He had a patch over one eye, and he played bass. And he was real cool, but he took care of me. I mean, I used to be scared to go in there with my drums and stuff, but it's not there anymore. But it was called the 1212 Club on Cutting Boulevard in Richmond. I'm saying, because, you know, Richmond known for being bad, you know. So I'm not here in Richmond, but my outlet was, you know, playing. I really dug Booker T and the MGs and all that stuff that was coming out of Memphis and the stuff that was coming out of Motown and stuff. So I was attracted to that, but I really love jazz. But if I had been in a community where I had the outlet just to play jazz, I would probably have been a jazz drummer. But I thank God for that, because I was able to have a balance in my playing where I can kind of shift from different genres, you know, like from a little bit of Latin, a little bit of jazz, a little, you know, R&B, funk, blues, and have you know, the foundational stuff to kind of get through the different genres. Because I think kind of like Miles, because Miles would say, you know, he'd like to keep things open so you could explore. But you do need the foundational stuff, and then, you know, you explore whatever's happening. Because I play off the musicians that I'm playing with. I'm just keeping a beat, I'll keep a rhythm, whatever the rhythm is for the piece. But what's happening within the ensemble is really important to me. That's what I feed off of, you know. But, you know, it's really like I came up in a community where, you know, the outlet I had was blues and R&B, and I listened to a lot of jazz and you know, played as much as I could whenever I could play it, I would play it. You know, some of my mentors was Ed Kelly. I grew up with Ed Kelly's nephew. He was my best friend. He still is my best friend. So, you know, I met Pharoah Saunders at Ed Kelly's house when I was about 15, 16. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were in there sitting at his table, and they were laughing and talking. He told me, yeah, man, these are the little youngsters, you know, in the neighborhood, man. They wanted to be musicians. And Pharoah said, yeah, he was looking at them. But Pharoah and them was in this deep conversation. He was telling, and I think at that time he was playing with Train, so they were talking about something, but they was laughing and kicking it up. And I'm saying, wow, that's Pharoah Saunders. And it's like, whoa. But those were my mentors, you know. So I would used to sneak in, you know, be in the back of clubs. We had all kind of clubs. I used to be in the back of clubs watching, listening to the band and just watching my back, because I didn't want to startle nobody, you know, because they usually had those screen doors, and the screen doors would be open, and you could look all the way through the club. Some of the clubs I'd go by and check the musicians out, you know. And I'd be back there and just like, dang, they in there. Wow. But, get back to you. I'm taking a rabbit trail. The community that I came up in, you know, there was, my outlet was more or less the R&B and blues. And the singing part of it, really, I have to thank Bernard Williams, my bass player and partner. We came up in a community together. I had a bit of a voice, and he used to always, man, come over here, man. Come around. He lived around the corner from me. He said, man, come over and check this tune out, man. You got to sing this tune. You got to sing this tune. I said, man, I never did want to sing. I was very comfortable back there just playing the drums. But he would always ask me to sing, and I was, man, come on, all right, man, I'll sing. Well, if I'm going to sing, I'm at least on my drums, I can sing. And it's just one thing led to another, and I just continued to sing. And I never forget, we had a career day at high school where, you know, it was one day out of the year where, you know, they would send kids wherever they wanted to go. If they were interested in drafting, they would go to a business where it's drafting. If you were interested in music, you would go to a music teacher or someone like that. And I used to go, we would go down to this lady called, I think her name was Unruh was her last name. But she had a music studio, and she was a voice teacher and stuff down there by around the lake. Matter of fact, she had a studio right across from Grand Lake Theater. And we would go there. And I never forget going to her, and she would test us and find out what instrument we played and just give us encouragement and give us some tips and stuff. And I never forget she tested my voice. She said, "What instrument do you play?" I said, "I play drums." She said, "You have a really nice voice." And she says, "I want to tell you another thing. There's something wonderful about a singing drummer. I'd love to see us and hear a singing drummer. There's something special about that." And that always stuck in my brain, even though I would still fight the fact, I don't want to sing, you know. So that's how the singing and the styles of music, you know, all this stuff was around me, and I was digging all of it. And that's what's kind of made, you know, I guess, developed me for who I am and what you hear in my playing and even in my singing. And singing has always been a challenge to me, especially to get up front and sing. That is really, you know, that's really, I had to really get used to that. When that particular opportunity would come, I would, you know, because being on the drums is like, you know, that's a safe place for me. That's a safe place, you know. It's like my security blanket, you know.
Right, yeah. I'll let our audience know that we're speaking to Larry Dan, who is celebrating his birthday today with a concert.
Yeah.
8:30 at the 57th Street Gallery, 5701 Telegraph Avenue in Oakland, and it's going to be like a reunion party. I mean, everybody's rolling through with their instruments, just celebrating our brother, and so it's going to be really, really fun. So you don't want to miss this party CD release.
Yeah.
All in the same evening.
That's right. And Janice Maxey Reed's going to be on keyboards, Tim Landis on Paul Brandon on guitar and saxophone, yours truly on drums. And like I say, I can tell you some people that may be coming, the great Marvin Holmes from Marvin Holmes and Uptight back in the day, he said he would come by. He's going to come by and check me out. And no telling what's going to happen tonight.
Yeah.
Who's gonna sit in and play, you know? But we
right.
You know, we're excited about having. It's gonna be a great night. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We definitely have to have you
too,
on.
Wanda.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna come. I'm gonna stop in my packing boxes. I'm moving and come on down. And help you celebrate 65. That's gonna be lovely.
All right. We'll take it easy today.
so you can make this performance. Yeah, and I want you to give your website and talk about how you came up with the name Rusty Feet for your record company.
Okay. My website is LarryVan.com. The record company website is RustyKeyRecords.com. And if you're interested in purchasing CDs or whatever, you can go to the RustyKeyRecords.com. The name is my grandkids. Two of my grandkids. I got to come up with something for my third. I got great grands now, so I'm going to have to create something else and have all their names in it. But my oldest grandson his name is Roselle, and my baby, his sister is Kiana. So I put the two, you know, Rusty Key. So those are makes up their names, you know.
Right.
And we do have some other dates. Can I give out some dates of some other performances?
Oh, yeah, please. Yeah, definitely.
Saturday 29th will be at the Sausalito Cruising Club, and that's 300 Napa Street in Sausalito. And New Year's Eve will be at a place called Clementine's, and that's in San Ramon. It's at 18070 San Ramon Valley Boulevard in San Ramon. So we'll be bringing in the new year there, and it's going to be really cool. This place is really cool because their theme is like where the bayou meets the bay. So they have some great New Orleans dishes there, the food that they prepare there. They have a nice, great menu, a lot of great stuff. So, and their chicken and waffles is off the hook. So,
okay. Super, have to check them out. Nice.
Yeah, but it is so good talking to you, Wanda. It's just really you're
great talking to you too.
Lady.
We've been trying to do this for a long time. Glad for a long time.
We finally hooked up. Yay.
Yeah, on your birthday, no less. That is so memorable.
Yeah,
so special.
Cool.
Yeah, super. We look forward to seeing you tonight as we toast you into your new birth year, your new solar return. Wow, it's a whole lot of, you're right at the beginning, the cusp of a whole new thing, huh?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So, as I say, I give all praise to God to still allow me to go out there and hit on them and, you know, make people smile and make them, get them to dance and clap their hands and stuff. So, it's nothing like that, you know. It's nothing without the audience, you know. Really nothing.
Right, certainly. Yeah, and we're gonna close the show with one of your pieces a little later on.
Okay.
Any particular one you'd like me to play? I was thinking about playing the one that you wrote.
Summertime,
Summertime in the big city.
Okay, that'll work. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Super. All right. Well, thank you so much, and you have a good rest of the day. And happy Kwanzaa and happy New Year too.
All right. You take care.
All right. Peace and blessings.
Bye bye.
Bye. Good morning, Veronica. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for hanging in there. It was wonderful hearing from you. Like, you are back in the Bay from Australia, no less.
I know.
And you are, like, singing. We know you as a person who, you know, develops theater performance pieces, and now you are going to be hitting with your first solo record. Like, wow.
Yes, wow. I know.
Yeah.
I know. Very exciting.
Yeah, Rising Beyond Borders. It's going to be, you're going to be releasing it on D-Day, which is a really important day to remember, you know, our women and our girls and the epidemic of violence, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Against women and girls. That's what's known as Valentine's Day, February 14th. So, mark it on your calendar, because Eve Ensler has actually called for 1 million rising, like million rising voices against this violence. So, wow, it's just so apropos that you would just, you know, have an album, have a song that you're releasing on that day. So talk to us about sort of this new shift in creativity that you have, you know, embarked on.
But first of all, let me just say that I am the actual single. The song is actually going to be released, officially released on January the 29th, 2013. So that's the actual release day, which basically means that it becomes available to the public through various online digital streams like iTunes, Amazon, Rhapsody, Spotify, and various other like streaming websites, as well as websites where you can actually physically buy the CD or the single. But if you want a free download of the single, all you have to do is subscribe to my my mailing list through my website, which is vixennoir.com, which we can talk about later. But and then you can get the free download that way. And that's very special because you become a superstar, which you already are, but officially superstar. You get that. And then I'm performing the song for the first time. It's like a world premiere, like before the official premiere of the song, on February the 14th as a part of V-Day, as a part of a V-Day celebration that's happening at Mango, which Arcane Creations is sponsoring, which is called Beyond, Rising Beyond Borders. Yeah, so yeah, it's very exciting.
Did you get my my email or my text that I need a copy of that song? So if you could send it to me before we go off the air, then I can play it.
I thought I did send it to you. You can get it.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. I could totally do that.
Right, thank you very
awesome.
Much.
No worries. Hey, I'm cool. Sick, so it could have been my imagination.
No, you could have sent it, but you know, technology being what it is, I don't see it.
Oh, okay.
Let's see.
And you asked me about the shift.
Mm-hmm.
My shift was shift. You asked me about the shift and how I went from singing, from being this performance artist and producer, director, and all that to singing. It's interesting because it's one of those shifts where it's like I've always known what I've always wanted to be a superstar. You know, I grew up in a time where it's like Grace Jones and Madonna, Annie Lennox with Eurythmics. And I was just such a, like, there were probably others as well, but those were, like, the three main ones that I really would just go, wow, you know, I want to be like that. I was a superstar like that. But I never really thought seriously that I could do it. I was just like, I doubt if I can, you know, sing like that. Although I was doing some singing, like in high school, and I did musicals and stuff like that where I actually did sing, but not solo, like usually in the background chorus or whatever. So it wasn't a big, you know, it wasn't me in the spotlight, so I didn't have to worry about that. If I hit the wrong note or I sounded horrible, it kind of got swallowed up in all the other voices that sounded good. But I would say the big transition happened for me when I was in Australia. I spent almost 3 years in Australia. Just recently I came back at the end of 2010. And I basically went there to, as a creative sabbatical, I basically went there to find, I guess, to reconnect with my creativity as an artist and to discover, you know, what else was there. What else, what did I have to express? Because most of my work over the years, the past few decades, has been mostly about empowering other women to find their creativity and to find their voices and their expressions. And so I've been kind of like a leader and a teacher in that sense, running a theater company, running a dance theater company, I ran dance companies. Like, I've done everything that's been about really ushering others forth. And I eventually got lost and I got burned out at the end of 2005, the beginning of 2006. I had a bit of a mental and emotional breakdown. I won't say a bit of. I had an emotional and mental breakdown around doing that work because it took so much, you know, to do it. And that was the break that just made me go, I need to get out of here. I need to go to another country. I need to immerse myself in another culture. I need to just experience other things and experience another, you know, world. And so while I was there, I had the opportunity to, I just started creating, like, solo works and pieces and things. I found an underground cultural, hub there that it was a little treacherous, like burlesque. I was already doing burlesque before I left, but then when I got there, I started doing it more. And for me, it wasn't so much about burlesque, per se, in the traditional sense. It was more about performance art, but had burlesque mixed in there. And I just called it erotic performance art. And basically, I just started creating these works. I had already started creating poetry and exploring that side of myself around, like, poetry, and then putting that together with dance and theatrical elements to create these, like, works that were a big hit there in the kind of underground theater performance world there. It was great. And it just allowed me to keep building my confidence and just exploring and playing. So eventually I had this deep desire to do a one-woman show. And the one-woman show for me was about kind of exploring where this desire came from for me to do the work that I had been doing with women, helping them to develop artistic pieces that derive from their erotic power. And when I say erotic power, I don't just mean their sexual power. You know, I look at erotic power as a much bigger force, a much bigger entity that encompasses our how we live our lives in relationship to family, sexuality, spirituality, our work, everything. And teaching women to use that as a resource to motivate them to live their lives true to who they are and boldly and bigly, and, you know, don't let anybody stop you. It's like, if this is what your heart and your soul desires, then go for it. You know, that was pretty much the crux of my work. So I didn't do that for myself, basically. I hadn't been doing it. And so this one-woman show was basically about, exploring where in the heck did I get this magic, this desire, this ability to know who I am as an erotic being, and then be able to convey that message and that work to other women to inspire and uplift them. It's like, where did I get this from, you know? And the erotic power does include the sexuality. And it's just like, you know, I've always been a sensual, you know, being. That's always been a part of who I am, even as a toddler. So I was thinking, where did this come from? Because no one taught it to me. You know, I didn't learn it from anybody. It's just a part of who I am. So I must have inherited it through my family line, my family bloodline, and my matriarchal bloodline, I'm thinking, because I didn't know very much about my dad. So I went for the matriarchal. And so that was pretty much the core of my one-woman show, was, like, looking at that and, you know, how I got into doing the work that I do and things like that. And I ended up touring that show. And during that show was the first time I started to really open my mouth and sing. So when I was in Australia, I think it was just really about an opportunity to be in an environment where nobody knew me. I didn't have any obligations to anybody or anything or any organization or anything like that. I was free, basically, to just create and be and be open and expressive and, like, and perform in front of an audience that did not know who the heck I was. And that in their response to it, to my work and this and that, it just gave me a whole new, confidence and a whole new kind of, you know, there was a freedom there that allowed me to be open. And so, you know, one day at one of the places that I was residing in when I was there, I think it was 2007. Yeah, it was 2007. And a voice just came to me and said, I want to sing. And I heard that voice and I went, okay, fine, we're going to sing. Like, and I'm thinking, okay. And so I was working on a piece that I performed in October 2007, which was the kind of a parody, a little parody number on My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music. So I changed the words to the song, of course, and made it a lot racier and funnier. And so I performed that song, and I was singing. Like, I was warming up with what warm-ups I could remember from when I sang back in high school doing musicals and stuff. And I just started practicing, and I realized I had a big voice. I was like, wow, check this out. And I didn't have to be scared or worried because it was a parody. You know, I could mess up. You know what I mean? I could mess up. It didn't have to be pitch perfect or whatever, but it went over very well. And then when I got back to the States at the end of 2007, that's when I set off on the course to create my one-woman show. And I knew that during my, I said, I don't care now that there's this thing about singing, I want my one-woman show to have singing in it somewhere. It doesn't have to be all singing. And so I, you know, decided to do voice lessons and this and that, and included singing in my one-woman show, took it back to Australia. I've worked on it for like a year, toured it in Australia, and spent some time there, came back, you know, a couple of months and went back, and then stayed for like a year and a half, another year and a half or so. It's like I couldn't stay away. But it was, yeah, that was like the turning point for me. It was like, I want to sing. And I'm like, okay. But I didn't, it still didn't hit me until it's like, how serious? Like, okay, you want to sing, but you want to sing cabaret? You want to sing like during your shows, just as a performance artist? You know, what do you want to do? And that part still didn't come through until I got back to San Francisco. But just prior to that, I was in a relationship there that was just one of the most unhealthiest relationships I'd ever been in my entire life. I don't even know how I got there. But because of that relationship, I started to discover that I could write songs and sing. Because at the end of that relationship, everything, God, every spiritual belief, like everything I had to muster within myself to leave that relationship, and I wrote a song. Like, a song came out of me. Like, melodies started coming out of me. Like, it's crazy. I was like, wow. Like, this melody came, I can't even remember it now, but I used to hum it and, like, you know, just vocalize it a little bit, and I was so proud of it. I was like, wow, this is great. What is this? And I think I did it for a few friends, and they were like, wow, that's really cool. And I was like, oh, okay, thank you, you know. And then I wrote a song that was basically a song that I wrote for this person to uplift them. Like, to me, it was like, let me write a song to uplift you, because I think you're in a lot of pain that you can cause this much pain for someone. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You've got to be in a lot of pain. So I'm just going to write this song for you. And then I had an opportunity to see this person. And then I don't want to name any names, you know. And and I had an opportunity to see this person. And I wrote a song for you, and I'm going to sing it for you. And the song was basically uplifting. It was like, keep your head up high. Keep your eyes to the sky. You are beautiful in my eyes. Like, it was just, it was kind of like a, you know, I think all of my work in my life has been about empowering women, empowering people to be the best that you can be, to lift your head up high, to look at your pain and honor, know that that pain is there, but you don't have to stay in that place, that there's a better place for you to go. And I think this song was just also a way for me to exercise my own pain and to move towards healing, you know. And that was, I just thought, I was like, when I look back, I go, wow, you're a crazy girl. You wrote this song, like, look, you feel better. I feel like crap, but you feel better. I actually write this song for myself, but... But the song was in part for myself as well. You know what I mean? And then I just went, wow. And I'm hoping, like, maybe one day I'll go back and revisit that song and actually, like, flush it out and really write it and put it, you know, and release it. But from that point on, things just started coming out of me. I wasn't really trusting them that they were, like, you know, going to be these great songs or anything. But I was like, wow. And it was such an amazing experience to start to feel these things, you know, this music coming out of me. So that's, I would say that those, you know, experiences and those situations and environments really, you know, helped me to make that shift. When I got back at the end of 2010, I was tinkering around with acting and this and that, which I do still want to do eventually, but my entire focus shifted 100% and said, this is something you've always wanted to do. As a child, you've always wanted to be a star. You have no obligations. You don't run a nonprofit anymore. You don't have to, you know, you don't have a job. You don't have a, like, you have no responsibility. No, you know, you don't have to do any. You can do whatever you want to do right now in your life. No holds barred. Something, this courage and conviction came through, which I think really does come through sometimes from the relationships and experiences in our lives if we allow ourselves to be open to those lessons. That hit me so hard. I went, okay, it's on. Let's do this. I'm doing this. Like, I've always wanted to do it in my life. I want to live and be the example of that which I have taught for so many years. It's my turn now. And that's where, that's how I'm, you know, on this path right now, this course.
So is that why your single that you're releasing January 29th?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that why it's called Dangerous? Because this whole idea, this whole notion of just free falling, I should say. there's no net down
driving.
There. And
right.
Yeah, is that where the title comes from? Dangerous.
Yeah, you know, that song just came to me. Like, it was out of all the songs that I've written and that I'm writing, that one, well, no, all of my songs kind of just come. It's I love it, how that happens. And I'm like, wow, and I have to record it because I'm not going to write it. I'm not going to be able to write the melody, you know what I mean? So I'll record the song. Sometimes it's the melody. Sometimes it's actual lyrics with the melody. And sometimes it's just the lyrics, and then I'll, like, bring in the melody and stuff later. But that particular song, I basically just did some free writing about, it was like the first song to say, I want to be born first. I'm like, okay. All right. It just came to me. It's so interesting. I can't even remember the process now because I think I started writing this song in the beginning of 2011. And, yeah, like right after I made that decision at the end of 2010, bam, the beginning of 2011, you know, all of these songs just like started coming out. And then that song, Dangerous, was like, you know, this is my coming out song. This is where I am in my life right now, which is out of all of the obstacles, out of all of the experiences that I have just had, especially the most recent ones coming out of that relationship, I'm not letting anybody or anything, even myself, hold me back from pursuing my dream right now. And the message is also for other women. It's like, if you have a dream, and this, of course, applies to anybody. It doesn't have to be women. But, you know, women, I'm partial to women. That's always been my work. So it's like I'm finally following my dreams. I'm finally living my dreams. I'm finally, you know, being the truest of truth to my desires and my passions. And nobody is going to stop me. And Dangerous basically is basically about that, but it's also kind of a call to people that are basically saying, like, you know, my music, my presence, you know, my passions, you know, my, you know, everything is you know, is, oh gosh, I'm like, I lost my train of thought. But it's like, I am dangerous because I am conscious. I am dangerous because I'm a woman who stands in my power. I am dangerous because I'm going for my dreams and nobody is going to, you know, stand in my way. I am dangerous because I'm confident in my sexual power, in my erotic power, in who I am as a being. I am dangerous because I lead a spiritually conscious life that allows me to be wholeheartedly true to who I am and not to anybody else. I'm not going to bend in this and that to, you know, please somebody else or to, you know, or to, you know, have someone, you know, like say people from the music industry, you know, want to bend me to go this way or you should do this and that and want to change this and that, you know. I even go through with my producer a little bit right now. It's always like, you should do this, you should go this way. You know,
yeah, and then we were cut off. So I'm going to play Dangerous. I know you're probably really anxious to hear it after all that build-up. So here's Dangerous, and for all those great reasons that Vixen Noir, a.k.a. Veronica Combs, just shared. And hopefully by now everyone has gotten their free download of Dangerous. but if you didn't, you can definitely purchase a copy. So here's Dangerous, and looking forward to having everyone join us for another edition of Wanda's Picks on Friday, January 4th. And I want to wish my mother a blessed and happy, happy birthday, which is tomorrow.
Danger. As a little girl, I wanted to be a superstar. Now I'm on my way, I feel that it's not very far. I'm a sexy diva, rising to the top. Don't you dare get in my way.